walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animals. Talking animals. Talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. Happy New Year. I'm Duncan Strauss, and I'm back. My thanks to Bev Capshaw, who provided a stellar edition of the show last week while I was enjoying some holiday time with my family. Today, my guest is Dr. Lori Marino, founder and director of the Camilla Center for Animal Advocacy, which described itself as the only organization focusing exclusively on bridging the gap between academic research and scholarship and on-the-ground animal advocacy efforts. A neuroscientist, Marino is an expert in animal behavior and intelligence, with much of her work focused on the realm of the evolution of brain and intelligence in dolphins and whales. Just before the holidays, she and a colleague coordinated Sea Pen Sanctuaries, progressing toward better welfare for captive cetaceans. A day-long workshop wherein expert panelists explored answers to questions arising post-blackfish about relocating these animals if they were removed from SeaWorld and similar operations. We'll discuss this workshop, the issues raised, and a good deal more when I speak with Dr. Lori Marino in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Also later in the program, I'll speak briefly with Rick Medina, the founder of Animal-Based Charities, about their Barkerilla event happening this Saturday in Tampa. And looking ahead, I should mention that we're less than a month away from WMNF's winter fun drive, and it's never too soon to support Talking Animals. Fast, easy ways to do that include going to WMNF.org and slipping a few bucks into the Talking Animals tip jar, or heading to the Talking Animals Radio Show Facebook page and click on Donate Now. Right now, though, let's move into our conversation with Dr. Marino, with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing us at dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Dr. Lori Marino to Talking Animals.
Good morning.
Good morning, Dr. Marino. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals.
Thank you very much.
I want to start at a very, very remedial level, because I suspect your training and academic orientation will sort of prominently figure into some of the things we'll later discuss this morning, and how we discuss them, actually. So you are a neuroscientist. What exactly does that mean?
A neuroscientist is someone who studies the brain and the nervous system, and primarily how biology and behavior and cognition interact. So I studied the biological basis of behavior and cognition, taking the form of studying the brains of many different animals over the years.
And how does that sort of orientation inform your thinking and the work that you do, as contrasted with, say, someone else with expertise in animal behavior who hasn't trained in that way or isn't a neuroscientist?
Well, I think that the neuroscience training allows you to look at some components of welfare issues, for instance, that one might not know about if one didn't have that training. Things like how stress affects the brain, how brain anatomy is related to behavior and cognition in humans and other animals. And it just gives you that extra dimension, that biological dimension, that grounds a lot of your ability to interpret behavior.
And so do you think because of that you might arrive at some different conclusions than someone else who, again, the sort of hypothetical person that I mentioned that is also interested in and maybe even has expertise in animal behavior but didn't have that sort of neuroscientist training or background?
Well, I think, it just gives you that extra biological grounding that allows you to see things that perhaps you wouldn't see. For instance, if you didn't know how to interpret the brain and the nervous system and how it interacts with the behavior. But I think any form of scientific training gives you a leg up on interpreting behavior in humans and other animals. And that's across the board, whether it's neuroscience or psychology or ethology. The training in the scientific method allows you to ask certain questions that you may not be able to ask otherwise.
So you have that discipline and that sort of rigorous viewpoint as you undertake these studies. Yeah. So when you were traveling the academic path towards your master's and maybe even especially towards your PhD, did a fascination with animals predate your studies, maybe even propel those studies, or did a decision to specialize in animal behavior and intelligence develop as you made your way down that academic path?
I think both, and that might be somewhat of an enigmatic answer, but animals have always been a central interest to me, and I've always wanted to know, what is it like to be another animal? And it could be, you know, a cat, a dog, or a bumblebee. But I always had that question in my mind, and the path I took to that question was not direct, but certainly I realized that in order to address that question, I needed to understand something about evolution, about biology, about the brain, and that was the common thread throughout my education. But as I tell students, don't worry that your route is not a straight line. It's often not. And those are the most interesting careers, in a sense.
Where you land, you might not have predicted, but
Exactly.
So one of the places that you landed, I'd like to ask you about a little bit about, is your doctoral thesis. Maybe you could sort of just tell us a little bit about it and sort of outline its findings, because again, I think this will be sort of become maybe a bit of a through line for the rest of our conversation this morning.
Well, this is an example of how sometimes you just have to follow your passion. I was a graduate student at the State University of New York at Albany working with Dr. Gordon Gallup. And Dr. Gallup was famous for doing the first experiments showing that chimpanzees recognize themselves in mirrors. But I looked around and I realized everybody was doing primates. And chimpanzees and other primates are fascinating, but I really wanted to look into something different. And that's when I became aware of dolphins and whales. And once I saw a photo of the brain of a dolphin, a bottlenose dolphin in a book, I was hooked. I thought, wow, okay, this is a big, complex brain, but it's not a primate brain by any means. So what does this brain do? And that led me down the road of studying mirror self-recognition and cognition and brain anatomy in dolphins and whales. And in comparing that with primates, that the comparison was the very interesting part of it.
Well, obviously, that from what you said, that probably really distinguished your work from others. It's like, okay, you guys can all do primates. I'm comparing cetaceans and primates, so look what I've got over here.
Well, the thing that's so interesting is that at the time, we knew dolphins and whales had large brains, but we really didn't know how large, say, compared with their body. And my PhD thesis was a study of relative brain size, or how large brain and body sizes are across primates and across dolphins and whales. And what I found was really interesting. I found that there are many dolphin species who have a larger relative brain sizes than even our closest cousins, the great apes. So the ability to actually put them on a scale and put a value or a number to that was sort of the big finding of my PhD thesis. And so we now know that, you know, when it comes to braininess, dolphins and whales are really way up there.
How surprised were you as you were pursuing the thesis, to find that, to arrive at that conclusion?
Well, I was surprised because one would assume that, you know, the next closest phylogenetic relative, the great apes, chimpanzees and gorillas and orangutans and bonobos, would be the most similar in terms of brain size regarding, you know, next to humans. And that's just not the case. In fact, there are many dolphins and whales who have significantly greater, higher brain sizes than even chimpanzees. So if you just look at this as a very broad measure of braininess, or, you know, how big the brain is compared to the body, that, you know, we've got some bottlenose dolphins and other dolphins who are really way up there and are in the position that we thought the great apes were.
And it sounds like at the time, at least, the sort of conventional academic wisdom was indeed the other way around.
Conventional wisdom was that, the great apes, obviously they are highly intelligent and do have large brains, but they were, in a sense, cognitively the closest to us. And they still are, but now we know there's another group in there, that the dolphins and whales. And what's interesting about the dolphins is that the brain is very large, but it's very different from a primate brain. And so that's the thing that really interested me. When you look at a chimpanzee brain, of course, they're fascinating, but it's basically the same brain as the human brain. It's a little smaller, but it's primate brain, and the primateness is there throughout. When you look at a dolphin brain, you know, all bets are off. You see something very, very different. So here is a very large, complex brain, but put together in a very different way than our brains are. And that's what's really fascinating.
Wow. Let me let folks know this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Dr. Lori Marino, founder of the Camilla Center for Animal Advocacy. She's also a neuroscientist and expert in animal behavior and intelligence. If you'd like to ask Dr. Marino a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email dj@WMNF.org or text 813-433-0885. Well, Dr. Marino, this is kind of leading to something I'm sort of chomping at the bit to ask you about, but let me just briefly detour for a moment because I do want to spend a few moments discussing the Camilla Center. So
yes.
When did you launch the organization and why?
The organization is 4 years old. As I launched it while I was still a faculty member at Emory University. The reason I did was because I began to see that there was a lot of scientific expertise and talent out there, especially in students, and that a lot of that was not being used to really promote welfare for animals or protect animals. In fact, if you're in a research department at a big research university like Emory, you witness students being told year after year that if you want to be in the sciences, you can't care about the welfare of animals, because sometimes you have to do things to animals that are part of the scientific protocol. And I witnessed that over the years, and it really bothered me, because I realized that students were being told that they had to make a choice between animal advocacy and science, and that's a false dichotomy. And that led me to, that was one of the reasons why I decided that it was time to have a science-based animal advocacy organization. And that's when I got the idea for the Camilla Center.
Well, one thing that we probably don't have time to address fully today, but as you sort of alluded to, it does seem like there's something of a real philosophical divide between academics who think sort of any study or work with animals should remain, again, academic or scientific, and those who believe it is okay, maybe even essential, to demonstrate some level of advocacy and reflect a passion or concern for those animals and animal issues.
Well, I always say that, you know, if you think about it, the scientists doing research on or about other animals really have a lot of expertise, and that can be very powerful in the advocacy arena. So in many ways, scientists can make the best advocates if they apply themselves. So I saw this empty area, and I thought that it really should be filled with something that has both academic science and on-the-ground animal advocacy. And this is not human-animal studies. This is about actually working on animal advocacy projects using science expertise and the scientific literature and all of that good stuff applied to actual problems and actual projects on the ground.
Yeah, well, I can't help but notice on a related note that, the Camilla motto, if that's the right word, is informed by science, driven by passion.
Yes, and that says it all, because we are combining the two. The passion drives our desire to advocate and protect other animals. The science is the tool that we use to do that.
Yeah. Here's what, at least I particularly was eager. When I first saw this, I actually wanted to get on a plane and come talk to you about it, but, you know, like before the holidays. So, because a particular interest of mine involves the whole topic of captive orcas, particularly those at SeaWorld, as reflected by interviews over the years with guests like Dr. Naomi Rose, David Kirby, yeah, Gabriela Capworth-Waite, John Hargrove, and so on and so on. So it's hard to imagine that I could be more profoundly curious about the workshop you and Dr. Rose presented just before the holidays, entitled Sea Pen Sanctuaries, Progressing Towards Better Welfare for Captive Cetaceans. So maybe you could just talk a little bit about the workshop, including to whatever extent that makes sense, you know, some of the other experts who participated in that workshop.
Oh, sure. So Dr. Naomi Rose and I held a workshop at the Conference for Marine Mammalogy, the biennial conference in San Francisco this past December, just a little while ago, a few weeks ago. And the aim of the workshop was to explore all of the different important components that would need to be addressed if we or someone were to build a sea pen retirement facility or sanctuary for captive orcas and dolphins, mm-hmm, and whales. And by sea pen, I don't mean just, you know, putting up a little barrier and making it into sort of the equivalent of a tank, but it's really not a sea pen so much as an enclosed area where they can live safely, but in natural circumstances. So it doesn't have to be necessarily a pen in and of itself. But we actually, it was standing room only, and it was so exciting. We brought together probably the best expertise that is available on this topic, and we covered everything from the veterinary issues to the legal and regulatory issues, to the training, to the engineering. And we had people like Michael Parks, who was one of the head engineers on the project to release Keiko, the orca, many years ago, talked about, you know, how do you build a facility like this? We had Dr. Heather Rowley, who is a veterinarian, a wildlife veterinarian, talk about all of the ways that all of the veterinary concerns that need to be addressed. And so we really covered, you know, A to Z, and the audience was very interested, had a lot of very, very good questions, and it was, in a sense, a way to come out and state, this is what you need to consider if we want to go forth and do a sanctuary for cetaceans.
Well, it just seems so, again, so fascinating, because in the wake of blackfish in particular, there's just been so much focus on SeaWorld and just kind of the life that especially the orcas there live. Well, there's protests, empty the tanks, et cetera. But the question that sometimes is harder to address, which is obviously what you guys sought to do with this workshop, is, okay, let's say that the orcas somehow SeaWorld agreed to say, all right, we're going to, you know, how would that actually work, and where would they go, and what kind of lives would they lead, which it sounds
exactly.
Like, yeah.
You know, I looked around and I realized there are so many efforts to try to phase out captive breeding of orcas and other cetaceans and to bring an end to, you know, putting them in concrete tanks and using them in these circus-like shows. But there's nowhere for them to go.
Yeah.
And so that has to be remedied before we can, you know, sort of get to the end point of those efforts, which is to get them out of these kinds of theme parks. So this is the necessary next step in the continuum of advocating for these animals. We need to have some place for them to go. And it's probably the case that most of them cannot be just unceremoniously dumped into the wild. All,
sure.
You know, they need to be rehabilitated. We need to take it on a case-by-case basis. We need some place for them to go while they are evaluated to see, you know, how well they would do being released. To them, we're born in captivity. They don't know how to live in the wild. So sanctuaries are a critical, you know, interim step for them.
But again, it's so interesting because it's one thing if there's PAWS or the Elephant Sanctuary in Tennessee and you take those animals from circuses or zoos, whatever. I mean, that makes sense. It works. You can kind of see. But I mean, the practicality of orcas. And so what were some of the preliminary, well, I wouldn't say conclusions, but what were some of the ideas about, like, where could such a pen sanctuary be located,
example? Well, I think that the location of such a sanctuary depends a lot on who is going to occupy it. So, for instance, if you're building a sanctuary for bottlenose dolphins, you're going to choose places that have more of a warm water environment.
Mm-hmm.
If you're building a sanctuary for orcas or belugas, you're going to be looking towards locations that offer colder water.
Yeah.
And so there's a number of parameters that have to match the animal that you're thinking of being, you know, having
sure.
a resident there. And this sanctuary workshop was specifically focused upon North America. So looking at the United States and Canada, essentially, as places where we might be able to site retirement facilities for orcas and even beluga whales.
Well, I have a zillion more questions, but there have been a few callers that have been already holding quite some time, so let's at least
sure.
work one or two in the conversation. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. Lori Marino.
Yeah, well, first of all, I want to thank Dr. Marino. She is one of the academic and activistic heroes in the animal rights world. She is absolutely spot on with her project for rights for non-human species. And I have a couple of questions and just to kind of intertwine with comments. One of them is how can we advocate for animals without doing scientific research that interferes with their natural lives? Especially, I'm concerned about animal experimentation and how some scientists, including conservation biologists, go into and interfere with animals' natural habitat and ecosystems in order to understand them better so they can advocate for them better, but in so doing, they're disruptors. The other thing I'd like is to have the esteemed person, Dr. Marino, comment on the issue of deep ecology, which basically says we don't really need science or anything else to tell us that non-human species have rights to exist without being interfered with by other species, and we should just, you know, stop interfering and treat them in an egalitarian manner the way we expect to be treated by each other and stop expressing speciesism. So again, thank you so much for your work, Dr. Marino. You are a hero.
All right, well, thanks for your call, and Dr. Marino, any way you'd like to respond? We got plenty more callers and emailers, and I got my own questions, so feel free to respond to his comments.
Yes, thank you very much to the caller. I appreciate that. I'll address the question of whether or not we even need science. In a perfect world, we wouldn't, and it is certainly the case that philosophically, you know, many of us in the sciences are driven by the idea that, you know, in an ideal world, everyone would have respect for each other, and that would go across species. Unfortunately, our species requires data or evidence to show that other animals are being affected by how we treat them. That's where the science comes in, where we have to show that, for instance, dolphins and whales die often and die early living in theme parks, or that, you know, monkeys or cats and dogs suffer in this kind of research. The first question is really interesting because I did scientific research. It wasn't invasive research, but the scientific research sometimes leads you to the conclusion that you shouldn't do anymore. So we know enough, for instance, about dolphins and whales and their cognitive capacities to know now that they shouldn't be in tanks. We know enough about primates and many other animals to know that they shouldn't be treated in the way we're treating them. That comes from the science. So the idea is not that the science isn't important, but once the scientific data are in, what do you do with that? How do you change with that incoming information? And that's what's really important.
No, it's an interesting contradiction almost, or paradox in a way, that especially in response to the caller's first question, that in some ways science isn't necessarily bad, and in some ways it sounds like what you're saying is it's in a way it's required to see when the science is complete. And I guess it also depends partly on what kind of science we're talking about.
Exactly. And I just wanted to mention that, that science is not the bad guy. Science is just a method of knowing something. Science can be quite benign, and it can be quite invasive. And so science, as a general concept, is really not the bad guy. It's just a way of knowing something.
Right. Well, that's the thing. And again, it depends on the science. So if you're, implanting some kind of rod in a chimp's brain or whatever to test something, that's a far cry from the kind of research that you've done and others have done to say, okay,
well,
what...
Well, here's an example of how that interacts with conservation. I know the caller asked about that, and that, now there's a lot of really good field research being done on dolphin and whale social structure. And all of that's being done in the field, and that's science. But it's science that can contribute to conservation and is not the kind of, it is not taking animals out of groups and all of that. So again, science really is a good thing when it's used properly.
Right. And science combined with experience, for example, one of the questions I had about the workshop and maybe even beyond is what sort of role does the earlier experience with Keiko play when sort of examining the whole idea of the C-pin sanctuary and how best to deal with again, in this case specifically, more specifically, an orca that might be released, let's say, from SeaWorld, but where does that orca then go, and how do they live their life from that point forward?
Right, right. I think that Keiko, the orca, is a very controversial issue because, he lived quite a bit after he was rescued. He didn't go on to live to many, many years. But in fact, that is really a success story because what they did is a proof of concept. They showed that you can take an orca who didn't know how to feed himself, didn't know how to survive, was really sick and in poor health, and bring him to the point where he was living in his natal air land. He was in the wild. He was hunting for fish. He was interacting with other whales. And he looked like he was a lot more content and healthier than before. So I think Keiko was a success. It was everything done properly? Well, we learn as we go along, and that's part of the whole process is you learn what is good to do and what is not good to do, and you take that and you put it into the next the next one. We learned a tremendous amount about Keiko, not only what works, what doesn't work.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because from really reading up on Keiko then and what people are thinking and writing about it now, I mean, it does seem to be a little bit of a fuzzy understanding of how that worked and or maybe some rewriting of history, sort of depending on what your perspective is or what your agenda is.
I think sometimes people are led to the wrong conclusion that all of the, orcas and whales in theme parks now can just sort of be dumped into the wild,
yeah.
Quote, into the wild, and they're going to swim off into the sunset.
yeah.
And it's sort of what I call the just add water idea. You know, take a whale, add water, and you're there.
Yeah.
And nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, these animals have to be rehabilitated. They have to be taken care of health-wise. And so, you know, what counts as a success is really just whether or not that particular individual is living the best life he or she could live, given that he came from a theme park.
If only it were so simple that if we got to the point where SeaWorld said, okay, uncle, we're done. But then, yeah, you can't just take those things. And yeah, whether it's add water or add whale, I mean, it's a very complicated thing. I mean, even as you said earlier about just the notion in Keiko's case and most of the others that we're talking about, the fact that they've never had to feed themselves. I mean,
right,
that's a huge question right off the bat. So
exactly. But the fact is that their lives can be vastly improved in a sanctuary.
Sure.
From where they are now.
Yeah.
And that's the difference that I want people to concentrate on, the actual improvement from living in a concrete tank in a theme park to a sanctuary where their welfare is a priority.
Are you trying to say, Dr. Marino, that swimming around and making free choices and doing kind of more like whale things is better than, you know, performing five times a day at Shamu Stadium?
Yeah, when
come
you're
on.
An autonomous individual.
That's crazy talk.
You want autonomy. Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Nuts. Okay. Exactly. Well, we have a bunch of callers and we're sort of already desperately short on time, so let me try a couple more here at least. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. Lori Marino. Hi, it's you.
Hello.
Go ahead, please. Hi. Go ahead. Quick question, please, for Dr. Marino.
Yeah, thanks for having Dr. Marino. Lori, just one question. As a scientist, I was curious about the brain size comparison. Humans use 30% max, 10% at rest. Do we know anything about how much the brain is being used by, say, a dolphin?
That's a good question. In fact, the idea that humans use a small percentage of their brain at any given time is really not true. It's sort of one of these mythologies that's out there. We use 100% of our brain, otherwise we wouldn't have such a large, expensive brain. And I imagine that it's exactly the same for dolphins and every other animal.
Thanks for your question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Marino, with that in mind and with kind of some of the things that, again, in the wake of Blackfish, Tilikum is certainly the highest profile orca, I guess, especially in the wake of Blackfish. But
yes.
What would you say just generally is the impact, given that we've now established these animals have incredibly large, sophisticated brains? What is the impact just on their sort of I guess, psychological well-being, leaving aside maybe for the moment Tilikum, although he's sort of the poster boy. But, I mean, just generally, what seems to be the impact of captivity and performing, et cetera, for something this sophisticated?
Well, the impact on highly intelligent, self-aware, highly socially complex animals like orcas, elephants, primates, large predators and so forth, is the impact of captivity on them is the same across the board. It means that they cannot thrive in those circumstances. There are just some things that don't work, and an orca in a tank just doesn't work. An elephant in a zoo display doesn't work. A polar bear in a small cage doesn't work, and the way that manifests itself is in, you know, lots of stress-related behaviors and essentially emotional disturbance, psychological disturbance that can have a big impact upon not only their quality of life, but, you know, whether or not they become susceptible to disease. And that's why so many of these animals die. And this is the case in elephants and circuses and so forth. It's all the same thing. You're trying to put a square peg in a round hole. And when you try to do that, something's got to give, and it's usually the welfare of the animal.
Yeah, and it seems to me without, you know, having anywhere near the kind of expertise you do, but also being a bit of a elephant freak, that as much as that's an incredibly difficult life, zoos and especially circuses for elephants, that it seems like the impact for orcas It just seems like they go more nuts to varying degrees. Again, the Tilikum thing being at the, but maybe that's not true. Maybe it's just seems more pronounced when you just hear about all the attacks and the raking and all the things that go on from whale to whale.
I think it seems more pronounced. There's certainly a lot of hyperaggression in captive elephants as well. But the point still is, it's still is the case that these kinds of animals, these highly intelligent, large, you know, roaming, highly socially complex animals just don't thrive in zoo and circus facilities.
Yeah.
And that's the take-home message.
Well, I guess we should make a quick aside. I think we're unfortunately sort of nearing the end of our time, so we won't be able to explore this as fully as I might have originally hoped. But I should note that the Ringling Brothers engagement in Tampa opens today. And so some of the things we've already acknowledged about just the difficulty on elephants. Now, of course, Ringling announced that they'll be phasing out elephants from their shows. But even that, I believe, is until 2018.
Right.
So there's still a rough road ahead for those things. So just in our last moment or two here, Dr. Marino, what would you say in the wake of the workshop or just generally is the sort of timetable we might be looking at for a CPEN sanctuary to be implemented, whether again for dolphins and that kind of waters or for orcas and belugas for the colder
water? Well, I think very briefly the timetable is on the order of, you know, a few years, but I have to say, and without being cheeky and all that, a lot of this will depend upon funding. So if we think that, you know, there's enough funding and it's enough resources to work very quickly, then of course that becomes a reality very, very quickly, relatively quickly. If it's something that, you know, has to go on for years, then, and we don't have the funding for, then that's what will happen. But either way, it's going to happen. And that's the really important point, is that sooner or later, there will be a sanctuary in the sea for captive dolphins and whales. And, you know, it's up to the public, it's up to the captivity industry to determine how soon that happens, and the important thing is that it has to be done right. It has to be done right the first time and every time. So that's why, you know, we have to take our time to make sure that it's all done properly.
But I love the sort of the hopeful aspect that it's coming. It's just the
It is. I think that everyone sees it, and right now it's out in the open, this whole notion of sanctuary visitations, and I think it's because people realize this is the next step in building a better relationship with dolphins and whales, and you can't stop that. That's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, that's probably the perfect place to leave it, sort of a hopeful note. And we've been speaking with Dr. Lori Marino. The Camilla Center for Animal Advocacy is the organization she founded and is executive director of. That can be found at Camilla, CAMMELA.org. Dr. Marino, thank you so much for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals. And I'm sorry, we still had some callers and emailers that had some really interesting questions. We just couldn't get to them all, but maybe we'll talk again. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
In a few moments, I'll chat briefly with Rick Medina, founder of Animal-Based Charities, about the Barkerilla event happening Saturday. Yes, you heard me. Barkerilla. Right now, though, it's time to step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner, hook to our conversation with Dr. Marino about orcas and just the stresses and strains of being in captivity and performing. Here's a piece called Killer Whale by Ron White in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
Early last year in Florida, at SeaWorld of Florida, an animal trainer was killed by a killer whale. Huh? Turns out there's a reason they didn't name them ocean ponies. Some things are exactly as they seem, folks. Killer whales kill. Pilot whales wear dark sunglasses. I'm not sure how the sperm whale got his name, but I'm not getting in the pool. That whale got his job back. They put that whale back in the show. Now, when I first saw it on the internet, I mean, this will be world news. It wasn't even news at all. They put the whale back. This whale killed three people. This is a serial killer whale. and he got his job back? If that would have happened at SeaWorld of Texas, that whale would have gone straight to the electric pool. And that's just a regular pool with a toaster thrown in it.
That's Ron White with part of a piece called Killer Whale, taken from his album A Little Unprofessional. Let's move now into the conversation with Rick Medina of Animal-Based Charities about Barkerville. Indeed, let's welcome Rick Medina back to Talking Animals. Good morning, Rick.
Hey, Duncan. How are you?
Good. Thanks so much for joining us again on Talking Animals.
My pleasure.
I've discussed animal-based charities on this show a few different times over the years, at least once before, I think, with you. But I think it'd be helpful for those who may not have heard those conversations to just ask you to briefly describe ABC and its mission.
Sure. Approximately 5 years ago when we started, we found a big void that there just weren't enough adoption events. And there really wasn't any money to fund them. So we decided to raise the money for those events, covering all of the expenses from advertising to liability insurance to table rentals to venue rentals. We cover all the expenses. The groups come in. They adopt out their animals. They keep all their money. They keep all their donations. And at the end of the day, animals find forever homes. They go back and pull more animals out of kill shelters, and just seems to have worked real well for the last 5 years.
Yeah, that's great. Again, it sounds like you really sort of underwrite the cost so that these groups and these adoption events don't really incur any expenses in trying to find homes for the animals.
Absolutely zero expense.
Yeah. So to fund that, there are various enterprises, including a thrift store, ABC-run thrift store, and events like Barkerville. So let's talk about Barkerville. Give us the lowdown of what all people could expect this Saturday.
We'll have a disc jockey at our sixth annual Barkerville. We're going to do a pub crawl. We do an animal Barkerville parade, which is real funny and an awful lot of fun. We've got wonderful raffles. There'll be a 50-50 as well as quite a few other really nice items. And like I said, all the money just goes right back to the rescue groups in some form or fashion.
I mean, I think who doesn't love a parade, but especially a pirate pooch parade? I mean, come on, you can't just see that every day.
No. We are the innovators of the pirate pooch parade.
Yeah. That's great. So I guess obviously the theme when people head out, we should make a point, I guess, of mentioning that again, it's this Saturday, January 9th. It's from noon to 5 p.m., if I'm not mistaken. It's at Christino's Coal Oven Pizza, or at least is that where the parade is? Or what is that the overall location as well, Rick? Or
that is the overall location. We will be departing there for the parade, and we'll be returning there.
Okay. So all the other activities, because it seems like there's a number of great-sounding contests, best pirate pooch, best pirate pup, best pirate float contest. Yeah. So obviously, for anybody coming out, they and or their dogs should be, you know, putting on their best pirate finery, I guess.
Absolutely. It can only help.
Yeah, I should think so. So, so Rick, if someone wanted to find out more about this, maybe driving around, couldn't jot some stuff down, is there a Facebook page or just send up to the ABC website? Where might they find out more details?
Yeah, they can go to our Animal-Based Charities Facebook page where we have the entire flyer.
Mm-hmm.
And if they have enough time and have any more questions, they can certainly contact me at area code 813-380-5674. And we just love to see them there.
Yeah.
Well, it means a lot.
Yeah, it's so great. It's a blast and it's fun just in its own right. But again, the fact that it's helping underwrite just a number of other adoption events and helping all kinds of animals find homes just gives a ton of the extra dimensions. So
in
great.
The 5 years that we've done this, Duncan, we've just started to tally up the end year's numbers. We've placed over 5,000 animals.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's just so heartwarming for us to do what we do. We're thankful for the support, and we do enjoy it.
Yeah, well, them's some bragging rights in the best sense of the phrase, I would say. So congratulations, that's great. So again, it's Barkerville this Saturday, January 9th at Christino's Coal Oven, 1701 East 8th Avenue in Tampa. And again, you can find out more by going to Facebook and just searching for animal-based charities. Rick, thanks so much for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Duncan, my pleasure as always. Have a wonderful day.
All right, you too.
Bye, sir.
Coming up at 11 on WMNF, it's Rob Loy and Radioactivity rolling into the noon hour. constitutes a full 2 hours of interviews, phone calls, news, and more with contributions from members of the stellar WMNF staff, including, of course, Everyday Ethics with Craig Kopp and company. Meanwhile, as the prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be offering a spiffy new Talking Animals t-shirt. Right now, it's time for animal news and announcements. First of all, news indeed from the folks at Animal Coalition of Tampa, who for more than a dozen years have really made spay and neutering easy and affordable. And for a long time, they had a Project Spay Day on the second Sunday of every month at the ACT clinic. But they're switching things up, I think making it hopefully even easier for folks to get their animals fixed, as it were. So the first Spay Day of 2016 will take place this Monday, January 11th. And you can find out more about that by going to actampa.org. Creative Loafing is getting into the big veg event business. They're holding Veg Out on Saturday, January 23rd. That'll be at the Creative Loafing Space and Courtyard, 1911 North 13th Street in Tampa. And that'll be from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. Aims to celebrate all things vegan and vegetarian with all kinds of vendors and some speakers and other things, so we'll keep you posted on that as we learn more in the run-up to this event on January 23rd, Saturday, January 23rd. I saw this little blurb in the news over the holidays. I'm just going to read some of it. Subway said Monday that it would use all cage-free eggs by 2025, joining other fast food restaurants planning to make the transition amid pressure from consumers and animal welfare organizations. So Subway, if I have this correct, is committing to make this change by 2025. Subway, hey, where's the fire? You really shouldn't be rushing into this. That's very, very impressive. Yikes. And sometimes you get these little things over the holidays as well that I wanted to share with you. It's the prominent sort of pet website, DoggyNames.com, released a ranking of the world's top 10 most popular dog names for 2015 in English-speaking countries across the globe. And Bella and Max have come out on top once again. So most popular female dog names include number one, Bella, number two, Lucy, number three, Daisy, number four, Molly, and it goes on from there. And on the male side, number one, Max, number two, Charlie, number three, Buddy, number four, Bailey, etc. And one last thing, just to look ahead a little bit, the Humane Society of Pinellas will be holding its pet festival January 30th. From 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at 300 Carillion Parkway in St. Pete. The mobile medical center, vaccines, microchips, etc., all kinds of other adoptable pets and fun. So you can check out more information by going to humanepinellas.org. And I think that's going to do it for today's edition. I am Duncan Strauss. You're listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to Name That Animal Tune. This is a giveaway. Please only participate if you haven't won something from WNF in the last 90 days. And there'll be a prize, a fabulous Talking Animals t-shirt to the first person who calls 813-239-9663 and identifies this animal song. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals.
Running to and fro, hard working at the mill, never fail in the mail, yet come a rotten bill. Too much monkey business, too much monkey business, too much monkey business for me to be involved in. Salesman talking to me, trying to run me up a creek, say you can buy it, go on, try it, you can pay me next week. Ah. Too much monkey.
We've just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Rob Loria is up next with what amounts to 2 hours of radio activity. I'll be back next Wednesday, January 13th, when my guest will be New York Times bestselling author Cy Montgomery, who's written more than 20 books, most recently The Soul of an Octopus, a finalist for the National Book Award. In reading Montgomery's book, I learned a great deal about octopuses, including that octopuses is correct for the plural. They are profoundly fascinating animals, far more complex than you might imagine. I hope you'll join me next Wednesday for my conversation with Cy Montgomery. We've got all kinds of folks calling in. Let's put one and two on here. Hi, you're on Talking Animals. You're on the air. Can you name that animal tune?
I Too Much Monkey Business by Chuck Berry.
Well, there you go. That's the complete package right there, sir. What is your first name?
John.
John? All right, cool. I'm going to put you on hold, come back, get your information, and send you off a Talking Animals t-shirt. Thanks for listening. Congratulations.
Great, thanks.
Also, we'll visit our website, talkinganimals.net, where we make available all sorts of information, as well as archives and podcasts of past Talking Animals programs. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page or Twitter feed and more. Please like us on Facebook, the show, and or me personally. Follow us on Twitter. You can also subscribe to our e-newsletter to find out more about our guests a couple of days beforehand, even a sneak preview, as it were, and other news from the Talking Animals world. That's all found at TalkingAnimals.net. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind, animals. Be kind, others. Be kind yourself. This is WMNF Tampa Community Conscious Radio. Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Wachee, and beyond. Thanks for listening. Speak again next Wednesday at 10 a.m. on Talking Animals.